Air Cascadia. Good morning, Cascadia. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, at 90.7 FM. Today's Wednesday, March 25th, 2009. And this is Air Cascadia, long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Tim Hermack of the Native Forest Council is here to set us straight on what forest thinning really means.
A W.R. Grace employee says that he helped the company delay health studies on asbestos.
And President Obama cozies up to NATO and the U.S. population.
Portland area weather, rain. Tonight, rain. Tomorrow, rain. Highs around 50 and lows around 35.
And first we go to regional news from around Cascadia. We hear from a lot of different agencies, state, local, national, on the subject of environmental stewardship. Some of the words go to the heart of the matter, but a lot of the talk is an elaborate policy mating dance of sorts among nonprofit wonks and government shills. Today, my guest Tim Hermack with the Native Forest Council is here to set us straight on the issue of stimulus money and what forest thinning really means. Good morning, Tim. Thank you so much for being here.
It's unfortunately my pleasure.
Well, talk about this. When the talk of course, money, everybody's ears prick up. And stimulus money, free money, that's even better. And we're going to use it to thin forests. What do you make of that?
Rape the state. More theft and destruction of publicly owned commonwealth. That which makes the Pacific Northwest great. Forests and the water, the fish, the climate, the weather, have been decimated by the timber industry. Teddy Roosevelt said it 100 years ago, that the industry is made up of liars, cheats, and thieves, and even worse. And if you look at the 95% of the Northwest that's already been clear-cut, that's what this thinning will do. It's another Trojan horse. And unfortunately, $1 billion of new logging money has already been passed and signed into law, hidden, buried in the stimulus package. Our Senator Wyden and Congressman DeFazio and the others are all very happy that they say they're going to double the logging in national forests for biofuels, cellulosic ethanol, and trees to electricity. How dumb can we get? Unfortunately, most of our green community, other environmental organizations, are all very supportive of thinning in the misguided idea that the timber industry was right, that more chainsaws and logging can restore the old growth, can make the forest healthy, can reduce fuels, that we can destroy the village to save it. It's a lot of nonsense when Oregon Wild, Wilderness Society, EcoTrust, Nature Conservancy, and even some parts of the National Sierra Club are supporting this increase in logging under the green alternative energy idea. Well, when you follow the money, you find that the Weyerhaeuser Foundation, Laird Norton, Bullitt, Wilberforce, Brainerd, Fred Meyer Memorial Trust, and others have sent millions and millions of dollars into the environmental community to support this collaboration, stewardship contracting, and more logging. This is a threat when you look at climate change and global warming and the loss of our drinking water, the salmon, and so many other things. It's clear that organizations and even our parents have voted no on saving nature and human existence on this earth. It's up to our children. They know better. They can still see, and they understand right from wrong. They're not caught up in the rat race. All of us pulling together can make a difference, but not when we sell out, not when we appease and compromise, not when we accept more death and destruction in the stupidity of economy.
Tim, thank you so much for that. I don't think I've ever heard anyone state it more clearly and better. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
My guest has been Tim Hammack with the Native Forest Councils.
There's some environmental good news out of Idaho. More than 1,200 acres of wetlands and other habitat near Challis will be protected under a new conservation easement. The Nature Conservancy bought the easement rights to try to stop development on the land, which they say includes prime salmon spawning habitat on the Possumeroy River and land used by sage grouse, songbirds, and big game animals. Meanwhile, back in Oregon, the log trucks keep rolling.
In Washington State, it's one step forward, two steps back. 2 years after voters compelled utilities to use cleaner energy, Initiative 937 backers say a measure in the state legislature would gut that law. The House Committee on Technology, Energy, and Communications today plans to consider Senate Bill 5840. That one raises clean energy goals but eases requirements of I-937. Initiative supporters say that the bill lets utilities off the hook by allowing them to count existing small hydropower and biomass plants towards those goals.
When California gets thirsty, Oregon feels parched. Santa Clara Valley Water District wants its Silicon Valley customers to cut back on water usage by 15% this summer, or at least until they can figure out how to get more cheap water from Oregon.
And to solidify Oregon's reputation as a center of all things environmentally sound, Portland may soon be home to the greenest large building in the world. More than a dozen businesses, nonprofits, and universities are working with the Oregon University System to get a piece of the Oregon Sustainability Center. Bottom line, another high-rise is going up near PSU. Now, let's get back to saving farmland, forests, and fish.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is handing out $170 million for habitat improvement projects aimed at helping species such as endangered salmon. The new grant program is intended to produce long-term ecological effects and create or save jobs, such as those of engineers and ecologists. But none of this will save the fish if we keep destroying rivers and the upstream spawning grounds.
And here's exactly how that's happening right now, right before our eyes. Planners with the Deschutes National Forest are reworking their blueprint for a proposed off-highway vehicle trail system south of Bend because of concerns from the public. The original plan, released in January, would have had motorcycle trails cut across the Newberry National Volcanic Monument.
Laid-off workers can enroll for free this spring at Oregon Institute of Technology's Klamath Falls campus and Klamath Falls Community College. The presidents of the two campuses announced yesterday that any Oregon resident who was laid off since October 1st can take classes for free on a space-available basis. Once in a while, we do something right.
Well, yep, we do seem to have some public will left, some backbone somewhere in there. Finally, we're heading in the right direction. Lawyers are trying to work out a deal to get one of Lane County's troubled RV manufacturers back in production. The idea is a limited restart of the production line at Country Coaches Junction City plant, with the company selling one or two vehicles a week directly from the plant and putting as many as 100 workers back to work. No amount of stimulus money goes as far as keeping people's jobs alive.
The U.S. Senate has confirmed former Washington Governor Gary Locke as Commerce Secretary. Locke has promised to focus on job creation and to closely oversee the 2010 census. Republicans don't like rumblings from the White House indicating that the Obama administration might seek greater control over the census. The Commerce Department has broad responsibilities, including the census, many aspects of international trade, oceans policy, and weather forecast.
Weather forecasting, I love it. But what's really interested, Barriott, in that is the issue of the census, which has this time around become politicized. Seems like yesterday, and as a matter of fact, it was yesterday, that former W.R. Grace employee Robert Locke testified that he personally helped delay asbestos studies. Locke says the 1980-81 OSHA study would have assessed the public hazard, health hazards of asbestos-laced vermiculite mine near Libby. Locke says that the outcome could have devastated Grace's vermiculite business.
In Kitsap County, Washington, 55-year-old Bruce Olson lost his home and now lives in a trailer. Why? Because of the cost of fighting two felony charges filed in May 2007 for growing and selling medical marijuana. Olson himself is a patient. This week, Superior Court jurors acquitted him, but as is always the case, no one can give Bruce Olson back his home or his life. The land of the free and the home of the brave.
Indeed. Okay, now we go to national news. Hours before President Obama was to hold a primetime news conference yesterday, a key Democratic senator, Kent Conrad, unveiled a scaled-down budget proposal. Conrad says that his proposal maintains key elements of the Obama budget plan. Conrad and other centrist Democratic senators have raised concerns about the long-term impact of the president's spending plan on the deficit. Joining us today, of course, is KBOO Spencer Raymond. He's been studying these strange birds for at least a week now. Good morning, Spencer. What do you make of this?
Yeah, good morning, Chris. Well, it was the second primetime news conference for President Obama last night. And as we've seen him do before, we saw him do it with the first stimulus package back in February, is he's going into campaign mode here. And this has become sort of a trend of his administration that is differing in a pretty big way from the Bush administration. Remember Bush, when he would rarely give primetime press conferences, but he would give addresses. He would say, this is what's going on. This is my plan. Da, 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 da. That was about it. What we see Obama doing now is really making a plea to the nation saying, look, this is what we have to do. This is what my ideas are, and this is what I'm asking Congress for. Let's rally the country to be motivated for my policy, and that's what he sees these primetime news conferences are. Chris, as you mentioned, you're right. The Democrats, even in Obama's own party, are trying to scale down his own budget. Obama admits that, yes, you know, he doesn't expect the Congress to take his budget, as he said, Xerox it and sign it away. But he did emphasize four main points that he wants to see through. That is the health care, education, environment, and to work on getting the economy back together, all while reducing the deficit. And it can sound confusing. How can spending be increased if the deficit is, you know, supposed to be decreasing? It's a long-term goal. It's 10 years out.
A lot of people are beginning to question the wisdom of this sort of massive deficit spending. Paul Krugman, among them, doesn't like it, and a lot of Democrats are starting to back away from it, but nobody else has an alternative plan. It's sort of like President Obama gave a conference, press conference last night, and all I got was a bill for a lousy $3 trillion T-shirt. So does anyone else, are there any signs of, in wrapping up, are there any signs that anyone else has a better idea?
Well, and that's the thing. No one really knows how to handle all of these, call them progressive moves that Obama wants to make, making a nationwide Medicare-like health coverage for all Americans, the cap and trade for fossil fuels. There's a lot of these things going that Obama and the Democrats are really the only ones pushing. And when Obama has people from his own party starting to chisel this away, that's why that's when it starts to get risky and confusing on who is in the lead here. And Chris, I might point out that we talked about this in the fall when Hillary Clinton was appointed to be Secretary of State. Who in the Senate is really strong enough or brave enough to stand up against Obama in his own party and say, wait a minute, we're not just going to sign this without doing anything. Is Pelosi going to do it? We'll have to see.
It's not likely, though. Thank you so much. That, of course, is KBOO's reporter, Spencer Raymond, joining us with DC Dirt, as he does every weekday morning. Thank you so much, Spencer.
Thanks, Chris.
America is still fighting to keep one of Europe's leading Muslim scholars, Tariq Ramadan, out of the country. Yesterday, a U.S. government lawyer argued against revoking a high-profile travel ban on Ramadan. The visa ban was instituted under former President George Bush. The ban has since become a test case for human rights groups. They've called on President Obama to stop refusing visas to foreigners on ideological grounds.
That was a human rights test case of the week. We have an environmental rights test case also before us. Let's see what happens now that the Environmental Protection Agency is unencumbered by the albatross that was the Bush administration. No disrespect to albatrosses. The EPA is sharpening its oversight of mountaintop coal mining to ensure projects do not harm streams and wetlands. How can they avoid harming or taking the top off a mountain? The agency is currently reviewing 150 to 200 applications for new or expanded surface coal mines. That alone ought to send chills up and down the spines of anybody who cares about air, water, and so forth. Many mountaintop removal operations are still pending before the federal government.
Wonder why we're still fighting a meaningless war in Afghanistan? Two words, oil and gas. Afghanistan hopes to attract foreign energy companies to look for oil and natural gas. The Afghan Ministry of Mines announced the first round of bidding to lease three tracts of land near the Turkmenistan border for exploration. This has been Headlines and Commentary from Air Cascadia for Wednesday, March 25th, 2009. Editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Kate Welch. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio station at 90.7 FM. Your support, and your support only, keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, Flashpoints. Catherine Austin Fitz analyzes the Treasury Department's plan for the economy, and Ali Aboudina talks about Gaza and the possibility of freedom and justice for Palestinians.
Thanks so much for listening, and have a good day.
On Flashpoints, Treasury Secretary Geithner leads the American public into a toxic waste dump of worthless paper, risking the entire economy to bail out Wall Street. We'll speak to Catherine Austin Fitz and analyze the Treasury plan on community business. Also, founder of the Electronic Intifada, Ali Aboudina, in the Flashpoint studio, gives a postmortem on Gaza and talks about the possibilities for justice and freedom for Palestine. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Nora Barris Friedman. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. As we go to air tonight, Barack Obama is getting ready to tell the American people, maybe he's already doing it, that he already sees signs of economic recovery and that his new Treasury plan will play a key role in the recovery from the recession. The president is urging people to look beyond their own short-term interests and to be patient. Joining us to talk about the Treasury plan and what is so exciting about buying worthless toxic stocks is Catherine Austin Fitz with Community Business. Catherine, my headline was this. I said, tell me if I'm over the top. I said, Geithner leads the American public into a toxic waste dump of worthless paper, risking the entire economy to bail out Wall Street and the banks.
No, you're not over the top.
All right. Tell us about this Treasury plan and how it's going to help us all a lot.
The Treasury plan is very much looks like a structure that the first time that the federal government ever did a structure like this was designed by me. So it was the bidding of equity in a pool of distressed assets, although it was the government selling the assets, not the banks. So this is not, you know, this is not a unique structure. Something like this has been done by government before in the 90s. But let me tell you what the problem with this is. The United States, Dennis, breaks down into about 3,100 counties or county equivalents, and we keep talking about these assets like they're something abstract, you know, out there on Mars, you know, Citibank's assets or Bank of New York's assets or Bank of America's assets or Merrill Lynch's assets. In fact, let's just talk about the mortgage and consumer debt-related portion of these assets. These assets relate to places. So, you know, Citibank has mortgage-backed securities and other assets that relate to probably every one of those 3,100 counties. So Berkeley, where you live, or West Tennessee, where I live. And the logical way, let's say we wanted to turn to the administration and say, here's how you ought to do this that's really going to solve the economy and build a strong economy for everybody that takes care of the real problems. Here's how you do it. What they're planning on doing is taking the toxic assets, and let's just use, you know, Bank X, And Bank X puts those toxic assets to in a pool, and then private bidders bid to own a portion of the equity, and government guarantees and leverages the financing of it. Okay? And then presumably the Fed keeps inflating, so the assets value go up or get held. Okay? Now, at no point do we say, well, let's just pretend for a second that all those assets are mortgage-backed securities and mortgage assets. Nowhere do we say, well, what's the problem with these assets? You know, because either the problem is that they were fraudulently made or that the people who live in the houses don't have any jobs. Okay? So you're not going to solve your value just by printing paper. You've got to get into the community and see, what do we do to build the health of the people and the place? So here's my proposal. The Treasury offered to do these kinds of financings, but rather than the specific equity partnership just being the assets of that, of one bank, why not make the assets about that place? So let's say we took everything in the Berkeley area. So the Berkeley, what's the county that Berkeley's in?
Well, it's Alameda.
Alameda. So we said, okay, we're going to create a joint venture structure, and we're going to put everything that the banks and the federal government, because remember, the federal government has a lot of distressed assets in every county. So we're going to create an Alameda structure. We're going to set it up so that it's a partnership, not of the federal government and private investors, but the county and private investors. It's going to be subject to complete public disclosure. So everybody in Alameda County is going to see everything. There's going to be no secrets here, okay? And so it's going to be subject to full disclosure. We're going to put the assets in, and then the goal is to optimize the value of those assets, but in a way that's great for Alameda County, because unless Alameda County's healthy, the value of those assets can't be healthy. So here's the next trick. Then what the administration offers to do is to give jumbo waivers. So if the municipality wants to be free to re-engineer how government investment is spent in Alameda County in a way that will improve the assets value by decreasing regulation on small business or by allowing monies to be moved between different categories, they can quickly get jumbo waivers that will make it much more efficient for federal government money to be invested in Alameda County in a way that will really create jobs and make small business healthier. Now, if you put together, if you took all these toxic assets along with the distressed assets that the government is holding, and you allowed place-based resolutions that were a public-private partnership, but where the municipality was at the table and citizens had participatory budgeting transparency, then you're talking about real solutions. And am I making any sense?
Yeah. But the question is, why can't we do this?
You can do this. What you can't do, we can build a healthy economy, or we can rig a financial coup d'etat into the private banks. Okay, but you can't do both. And the reality is, there are reasons why a lot of people would like to go along with rigging the money into the private banks. One is, a lot of this paper was fraudulently issued. So the idea of turning it over to Carlyle Group, who will very quietly work it out, you know, there's an attraction to that, because Carlyle keep the secrets.
And nobody gets busted for busting the economy.
Well, nobody gets busted because the papers are flying and everything's moving so fast, there's no time to even get a track record. The reality is, if you bring things down to the ground and everybody in Alameda County sees that, you know, 10 houses on their blocks had 10 mortgages each, people are going to start asking questions. But those are the questions we're going to have to ask.
And that is a very, not only is it a distinct possibility, it's happening all the time, where judges around the country can't really figure out when people...
they can't get the note, because the note's supposed to be in 10 places. It can't
all
be
right.
10 places at once.
Give me the one-minute version again of how it's possible that nobody knows who owns your house.
Because the mortgage system issued a huge amount of mortgages quickly, and if my hypothesis is right, they issued a lot of fraudulent mortgages, and they flew around in a lot of pools. And so there's no clear record. Now, there is, you know, there is a master digital database that is supposed to have all these things, but let me give you an example. When I was the Assistant Secretary of Housing, I would get lists of foreclosures that said, you know, and this happened at the RTC, too.
That, this was, you know, around the whole SNL meltdown.
Right. We had 10 buildings on this block, you know, 10 homes that we owned through foreclosures, and you'd go to that block and there were no houses there. And you'd say, what is this about? And that's why I push so hard on place-based data and making the data available to citizens in accessible ways so that they can see the sources and uses of government monies and programs in their place. Because the best internal financial control to stop all fraud is citizens see where the government money is supposed to be going, and this kind of stuff can't happen. And that's why, you know, I look at what the Treasury is proposing, and I know it's complete bunk, because everybody knows the value of all real estate and all consumer receipts. All this stuff is local, okay? You know, is the house properly taken care of? Does the person who lives in the house have income? You know, is there, you know, are there jobs available? Is there healthy business and small business in that place? Is there safety? Because, you know, if everything's lawless and there's crime, there's, you know, so it comes back to really basic stuff. And if you're gonna build the economy, then you have to build healthy people, healthy families, healthy small business, healthy businesses, you know, good schools. It's all, you know, it's everything grandmother taught us. So there's nothing new in this world. But you can't keep churning these assets in an abstract reality up on Wall Street with lots of government guarantees and games, because that's just scams. That's just, you know, that's got nothing to do with the real world. You have to get back to the real world, and you have to organize the paper in a way that it relates to the real people and the real things, and you have to engage the citizenry in, okay, how are we going to re-engineer all of this to build a healthy economy? I'll give you a perfect example.
All right, we only have 2 minutes left, and I have one question.
Okay, go.
You can have 30 seconds.
Okay, so when I was Assistant Secretary, I found a town in New Mexico where 70% of the mortgages were in default and owned by Freddie, Fannie, and FHA. And I said to my staff, this is ridiculous. The town needs to reinvent itself. Have the town come in and create some kind of trust or corporate vehicle and swap a stock for the mortgages, because they have to reinvent themselves. And my staff looked at me like I was nuts, but that's what has to happen in America. Every municipality and county has to come to the banks and the federal government and say, you know, here's a plan to completely take over and reposition everything here, because we have to reinvent ourselves, and we can't resolve the debt problem without resolving where government investment goes in this place and whether it's optimized to build healthy communities.
All right, we have 60 seconds. Everybody was really excited. The stock market was way up yesterday. Interesting, stocks up, but bonds staying neutral or going down. What's dangerous about stocks going up and bonds going down?
It's called a bear trap rally. We've done a whole series of things to juice the stock market up, including inflation. To do that, it's just like giving steroids to a body. We've made the body much weaker deep down. So watch out. This is very dangerous.
And we have 15 seconds. What are you looking for? If this thing goes down the way you think, what are the first signs we should be wary of?
Inflation. Inflation is the price of your groceries going up. And our risk here is, for this plan to work, you need very massive and significant inflation, which is what the Fed appears to be committed to. You know, I think we've...
So then all our worth, all our money, our little few bucks here and there gets reduced to nothing as they print money and bail out the bank.
Hey, switch it into brooms and toilet paper, because, you know, that's going to go up in value. Dollars may
brooms
not.
And toilet paper.
I'm
all
serious.
Right. This has been Catherine Austin Fitz, Community Business, and we need brooms if we're going to clean up this place. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints. Talk to you next week, Catherine.
Okay.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Stay tuned. Nora.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our focus on the unraveling situation inside occupied Palestine. As the U.S.-supported and armed Israeli massacres in Gaza took place earlier this year, as the Israeli elections resulted in the installation of extreme hardline right-wing Zionists to the Israeli Knesset, and as the acceleration of home demolitions and land theft takes place every day in the West Bank, Palestine once again suffers under the weight of crushing injustice and occupation. That's all the more reason to invite onto this program the voices and analysis of those who keep eyes and ears tied to the ground, providing the international civil society with context, background, and motivation to keep us all working for justice and freedom for Palestine. Today, that voice belongs to Ali Abunima, here with us live in the Flashpoint studio. Ali is the co-founder of the electronicintifada.net and is the author of the book One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Electronicintifada.net is the web's most important site for information and analysis on Palestine, Iraq, Lebanon, and the greater Middle East. Ali, it's so great to have you back with us on Flashpoint.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be in the studio with you face to face.
Well, I think Rashid Khalidi, the historian, said that what happened in Palestine in 1948 was the greatest armed robbery in modern history. And Gaza is one more crime scene that we can add to that list. Let's talk about the aftermath of the Gaza massacres first. The humanitarian, the social, and the political ramifications of what Israel did to Gaza, supported by the U.S., you know, 1,400 Palestinians killed, 450 of them children, thousands wounded. Talk about where we're at right now in terms of Gaza.
Well, you're right to use the word crime scene because it's literally a crime scene. And you recall that during the Israeli assault from December 27th to January 18th, Israel banned journalists from entering the Gaza Strip. It's very clear now why they did that, because despite the efforts to censor and suppress what happened, the incontrovertible evidence of massive war crimes, as Richard Falk, the UN Special Rapporteur, called it in his report yesterday, that what happened in Gaza would seem to constitute a war crime of the greatest magnitude under international law. And the evidence is coming out from multiple sources. There have been reports now by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, of course the UN Special Rapporteur, the UN Human Rights Representative on Children in Armed Conflict, the National Lawyers Guild delegation that went, numerous other independent observers, the Palestinian human rights groups, and so on. But most shockingly or sensationally in the last few days, the testimonies of Israeli soldiers themselves. And I think it kind of shows some of the underlying racism that the war crimes that you have been talking about on your show, we've been reporting on the Electronic Intifada for months, do not get mainstream attention until the perpetrators themselves start to talk about them. The victims are not believed. And this is pretty typical. I mean, if you think of, you know, how we see crimes treated in our own society, very often women who are victims of sexual assault are not believed, you know, because they are disempowered, and so it is here. But also, I think what has emerged is the massive evidence of the complicity of the United States. The Amnesty report, in particular, which documented in detail the types of weapons used by Israel, produced and sent by the United States, which according to Amnesty were found in hospitals, in private homes, in school playgrounds all over the Gaza Strip. And to me, this is something that's just as important, the complicity of the United States government in perpetrating these crimes and in helping to cover them up.
Well, let's talk about the international legal body's responsibility of holding these war criminals accountable, and not just the Israeli officials who ordered these attacks and these massacres, but the United States corporations and the governmental alliance with the Israeli military and its government. What can you say about the International Criminal Court, the United Nations? What is being done right now in international civil society to really take Israel to task and hold them accountable?
We're at a very crucial moment, because we're going to learn now whether these international institutions really do what it says on the tin. whether they are really going to uphold international law, human rights standards, the Geneva Conventions, and do that for all human beings, and to treat all human beings with equal dignity, or whether they are simply going to be weapons that the strong use against the weak, that the victors use against the defeated. It's one thing for the courts to be used against Charles Taylor in Liberia, or against Omar al-Bashir in Sudan, or against Slobodan Milosevic. The question is, can these same weapons of justice be used against perpetrators that are armed, backed, and supported by the United States and its allies? And that's what we're going to find out, and it's a real split, because what we see now is people of integrity within these institutions, people like Richard Falk, a respected professor emeritus at Princeton, world expert on human rights and international law, giving a legal report to the UN Human Rights Council. We have Radhika Kumaraswamy giving a report on children in armed conflict again. We have groups like Amnesty, as I mentioned. And what's the response of the Obama administration? It was yesterday the spokesman for the Clinton State Department, Robert Woods, dismissed the report of Richard Falk, the special rapporteur, using exactly the same language as the Israeli government, saying that Falk is biased. So launching an ad hominem attack on a respected UN appointed official, rather than dealing with the substance of the accusations, dismissing it. So, I mean, what we see, unfortunately, from the Obama administration is precisely the same policy as the Bush administration when it comes to Palestine. But the test there, really, I think, is for international civil society, whether we're going to let them get away with this. One of the encouraging things is the use of universal jurisdiction. The ICC, go back to that, the International Criminal Court. The problem with that, the way it was set up so that it couldn't be used impartially. States that are not signatories are beyond its jurisdiction unless the Security Council refers a case to them. So even though Sudan is not a signatory, the reason the president of Sudan was indicted is because the Security Council asked the ICC to investigate. Now, of course, with the Security Council, with the U.S. and its other allies wielding a pro-Israel veto, there's almost no chance the ICC is going to investigate, despite the massive evidence. But you have groups like the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, assisted by some other international NGOs, who've gone to the courts in Spain. The Spanish courts have agreed to investigate. And you see Israeli officials now getting very nervous about getting on planes and traveling to other countries, because they face the real risk of a Pinochet situation where they might find themselves under arrest. So it's tremendously important that the grassroots effort to use and support the use of universal jurisdiction continue, and boycott, divestment, and sanctions, because that's what's ultimately going to put pressure on governments to hold these people accountable. And here in this country, where we have such an enormous responsibility, look at the situation where Hillary Clinton goes to Sharm el-Sheikh to that summit, allegedly about giving aid to Gaza. And she says the United States is going to pledge $900 million on condition that the Palestinians do what we want. You know, Hillary, when you give humanitarian aid and you attach political strings to it, it's not humanitarian aid, it's blackmail. So we have Palestinians who are living amidst the rubble in tents for the third, fourth, fifth, tenth time in their lives in Gaza, without clean water, without medicine, without food, nursing the wounds from the horrifying weapons used by Israel and sent by the United States. And they're being told the humanitarian aid is conditioned on you doing our bidding politically, supporting the puppet leaders we choose for you, recognizing in Israel, and so on. And yet, the $30 billion that the Obama administration has pledged to send to Israel in military aid over the next decade is totally unconditional. I am sure that if we were to have an open debate about that in this country, the vast majority of people in this country would be utterly horrified and outraged that medicine for children, cement and bricks to rebuild homes and schools is conditioned, but the F-16s, the bombs, the flechette weapons, the phosphorus bombs, all made in the United States, is sent to Israel unconditionally, despite the massive evidence staring us in the face of the, to quote Richard Falk, war crime of the greatest magnitude.
That's the voice of our good friend Ali Abu Nima. He is the co-founder and editor of electronicintifada.net. And he's in town tonight in Palo Alto at 7:30 p.m. at the Fellowship Hall, First Presbyterian Church. Tomorrow night, back in Berkeley for an event benefiting Middle East Children's Alliance at the First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way at 7. Ali, let's talk now about the West Bank, the acceleration of colonization by settlement activity, settler violence, home demolitions, violence against peaceful demonstrators by settlers and the Israeli military. Again, we have Hillary Clinton saying that the settlement expansion is, quote, unhelpful. What, you know, given the timing of the new Israeli Knesset with Avigdor Lieberman, a self-described ethnic cleanser who lives in a settlement colony inside the occupied West Bank, about to be confirmed most likely as the foreign minister in the Knesset. You know, today we saw more settlers coming into Umm al-Fahim across the Green Line chanting death to Arabs. Give us a sense of kind of the mood on the ground in the West Bank and how that's spilling over into the Green Line and kind of what's happening there, how you see that playing out.
Well, some people are very upset that Avigdor Lieberman, the leader of this racist party in Israel, will be the foreign minister. I'm actually very happy because I think it's truth in labeling. Avigdor Lieberman today is the true face of Israel. And of the people, in the sense that the vast majority of the Israeli public say they support the policies, and to the extent they opposed what happened in Gaza, they opposed it because they thought that not enough violence was perpetrated.
82% there.
Yes, said that it was, yes. And something like more than 90% among Jewish citizens of Israel. Of course, the 1.5 million Palestinian citizens of Israel were overwhelmingly opposed to what happened. I mean, yes, the acceleration of colonization in the West Bank is proceeding apace. Just in the past couple of weeks, the occupation municipality in Jerusalem confirmed its intention to demolish the homes of 1,500 Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem in an area called Silwan, in order to cleanse them from the area, in order to establish a Jewish-themed park in East Jerusalem. So this is the continued religiously, racially motivated assault on the physical and cultural presence of Palestinians in Jerusalem. And another event that got almost no coverage in the past few days is Palestinians attempted to hold cultural festivities in occupied East Jerusalem, celebrating Arab culture in the largest Palestinian city in Palestine. And there were all kinds of cultural activities planned in schools throughout East Jerusalem. Israeli police, armed police, paramilitary police, actually went in to the Ambassador Hotel in occupied East Jerusalem, to the Schmidt School, to all the schools, confiscated flags and balloons and literature, cultural literature, shut those things down, arrested people, and banned these cultural celebrations. I would like to know what the reaction would have been if armed paramilitary troops had done that to a Jewish community somewhere in the world, if the Chinese had done it to Tibetans. There would have been a worldwide outcry. But this is going on in occupied East Jerusalem, where Palestinians are not even permitted to celebrate their own culture, their own language, their own art in their own largest city. They are met with the most brutal response from armed thugs of the Israeli state. So this is the situation across the West Bank. Israel has announced in the past few months the construction of thousands of more Jewish-only homes in the settlements. And we're told, actually, that the West Bank is the, you know, in the U.S. and Israeli approach to the West Bank and Gaza, that there's a carrot and stick, that the Palestinians are being deliberately starved and blockaded and punished in Gaza for making the mistake of democratically electing the representatives that they wanted, whereas the West Bank is supposed to be the shining example. And that's what's going on there. You have mass arrests going on. Just last week, the Israeli occupation forces kidnapped 10 Palestinian members of parliament and academics, including former deputy prime minister and minister of education, Nasser al-Sha'ir, and these were all democratically elected representatives, simply kidnapped and picked up, and they now presumably join the 40 or so other democratically elected members of the Palestinian Legislative Council who were kidnapped by Israel after their election in 2006. And we have total silence about this from the United States. In fact, total support for it, I wouldn't say silence, which is why it is urgent that we see a broad-based, and we are seeing, but it needs more support, a broad-based boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, exactly as we did in this country with the anti-apartheid movement, because there's no other force for accountability.
And I want to talk more about BDS in one moment, but let's get back to that word, that idea of democracy and the democratic process, because, you know, here in the States, in Jewish communities and you know, in other communities across this country, we hear that, you know, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, that, you know, Palestinians inside the state enjoy civil rights that are not found anywhere else in the region. You know, today, as we saw what was happening in Umm al-Fahim, the Israeli police commissioner of that area said that he was protecting democracy, basically protecting the democratic rights of those settlers who were chanting death to Arabs inside a predominantly Palestinian town. How is democracy protected? I mean, has democracy lost all of its meaning?
Well, you know, democracy in Israel has always meant the right of Jews to dominate Palestinians, and that's all it has ever meant. And so we have this march by the settler thugs from Hebron, led by Baruch Mazel, who has carried out incitement and attacks on Palestinians for years, including violence against them. And what we see now is the militant West Bank settler movement taking the tactics that it developed in the West Bank and turning them against Palestinian communities inside Israel. So we saw that late last year in Acre, in Acre, in the north, where you had settler thugs basically carrying out a pogrom against Palestinians in the city. You've seen it in Jaffa, where settlers are moving in. Jaffa, of course, is a Palestinian town on the coastline south of Tel Aviv. Most of its Palestinian residents were ethnically cleansed in 1948, but there is a Palestinian population that survives there. They now face a threat from these settler thugs. And you have these settlers from the West Bank now marching through Palestinian cities like Umm al-Fahim in Israel. And we're being told, on the one hand, cultural celebrations in children's schools in East Jerusalem are being shut down by armed paramilitaries. Those same armed paramilitaries are actually protecting these racists as they march through Arab towns. It's very similar for some of your listeners who are familiar with the situation in Northern Ireland in the past, when you had these bigoted Orange Order marches being forced through Catholic areas, through nationalist areas, and the police would protect these marches and suppress the residents whose right to safety, whose right not to be abused by bigots, whose right not to be harassed was being violated. So Israel is following very much that line, but whereas the rest of the world has moved on and I think is moving to a more enlightened place, Israel seems to be devolving to a form of thuggish ethnic tribal hatred that is uniting the whole society and making anything permissible. I mean, the other shocking story that came out in the past few days is of the T-shirts. That, you know, the Israelis also tell us, in addition to we are the only democracy, they also say we have the most moral army. And I think now, you know, many people around the world have seen the images of the T-shirts that are being openly sold in the streets and being created by Israeli soldiers after Gaza, of showing, celebrating the killing of Palestinian children. The one particular T-shirt of showing a pregnant Palestinian woman with a bullseye on her belly and the slogan saying, "One shot, two kills." Just in the plane, I was reading about the T-shirt which has had a picture of a Palestinian mother screaming as her baby is lying shot on the floor with the teddy bear next to it. And with the bullseye over, again, celebrating this kind of killing. And reading a real story in one of the testimonies from one of the National Lawyers Guild delegates of a father who watched his little girl being shot and the teddy bear she was carrying being covered in her blood. And yet, these are things to joke about and celebrate in the State of Israel today.
Again, that's the voice of Ali Abonima here with us in the Flashpoint studio. Let's talk about the global BDS movement, boycott, divestment, sanctions. It was such a momentous and wide-ranging movement in the 90s to finally bring down South African apartheid. Mm. People say now that globalization has kind of come in between a realistic approach to BDS now, that it's really hard to kind of extricate Israeli products from activism, and you know, capitalism has kind of played a role in that. What do you say to people who don't think that BDS is an appropriate way to hold Israel accountable for its crimes?
I'd say they're mistaken, and I'd like to explain why. BDS stands for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So those are three strands of a strategy, but each is slightly different. The boycott includes not just boycott of Israeli goods, but boycott of Israeli universities and cultural institutions. And we saw recently the Bat Sheva dance company, an Israeli-sponsored dance company, touring the United States. And I think in almost every city they went to, they were confronted by Palestine solidarity activists in very creative ways, protesting and having a presence and challenging those who'd come as an audience to confront the morality of sitting there, enjoying beautiful dance while this slaughter is going on in Gaza. And the slaughter continues, by the way. It's not by any means over. Just the other day, there was an article in the New York Times which quoted an Israeli foreign ministry spokesman, Arye Mekel, saying that the Israeli government was going to allocate millions more to send artists, novelists, dance companies, theater companies around the world to improve Israel's image. So if Israel is actively using cultural production and artists as part of its state propaganda effort to cover up the crimes in Gaza and to try and clean up Israel's image, it is perfectly appropriate and necessary to respond to that with protest and boycott. Divestment, we saw the Hampshire College, which was the first in 1977 to divest from South Africa, being the first to divest from companies doing business or selling arms to Israel, a great success. I think, to put this in context, You know, when I was in college, the anti-apartheid movement was at its height, and it was very mainstream. And, you know, over the past few years, people have said to me, look, you know, it'll never get to that stage with Israel. It's just too difficult. There's too much support. And I think we're seeing every day how wrong that analysis is. And the first, you know, it took from the Sharpeville massacre in 1960 until the 1980s, so several decades, for the anti-apartheid movement to become mainstream in the United States. We've gone from 2005, the first Palestinian national call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, to 2009, where we're already reaching that level of consciousness, if not in the United States, certainly in Europe. I mean, what could be more inspiring than South African dock workers refusing to unload Israeli ships, just as dock workers around the world refused to unload South African ships during the time of apartheid. We've seen transport workers in Norway go on strike in solidarity for people in Gaza. We've seen, you know, actions all over the world, trade unions, universities. We've seen in dozens of universities around the world, particularly in the UK, students occupying buildings and making demands of their administrations to divest, to halt collaborations with Israeli universities, which are so complicit in the occupation and the violence. And this movement is growing apace. It's very, you know, it has a long tradition in this country. You know, the Montgomery bus boycott was a boycott. Nobody says it's discriminatory against white-owned bus companies for them to have had that boycott. Everyone understood that this is a form of nonviolent resistance, of mass mobilization, that it is used to further the aims of universal justice, and that it is powerful, that it holds not just Israel to account, but it's a way to hold our own politicians to account. And we want to get to a point where they did with the South Africa anti-apartheid campaign, where no member of Congress, no mayor, no state governor feels comfortable opposing this movement, where it becomes so mainstream, so rooted in the universal values that we espouse as a society, that everyone supports it. And I'm confident we're going to get there. I've been traveling all over the place, and I am so inspired by the activism I'm seeing.
Oh. All right, well, we're going to leave it right there. That's the voice of Ali Abunima, co-founder and editor of the electronicintifada.net and the author of One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. And, of course, check out electronicintifada.net. Ali, as always, it's so good to see you in person and to have you here on Flash Point.
Thank you, and you reminded me. I want to say I hope people will come not just to hear me, but also to support the Middle East Children's Alliance, because they're doing tremendous work in Gaza. They're not just providing the opportunity for us to have these discussions here in our communities. They're actually working on the ground in Gaza, and we're going to be raising support for that. It's very important people show up and provide that.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, your local community radio station. It's 10:59 a.m. Coming up next at 11 o'clock on the Recovery Zone, the featured guests are John Sorensen and Seth Truby, co-founders of Sunnyside Neighborhood Energy, which aims to build a local renewable energy system based at the Sunnyside Environmental School. At 11:30, Todd Wilson will speak with Elizabeth Redmond about Project PowerLeap. They developed a flooring system that harnesses the kinetic energy of human motion and uses it to generate electricity.
Hi, it's 11 o'clock in the morning here in Portland on KBOO Radio, and I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, and it's a show about people and organizations who are working to heal our world. Today we're going to be talking about Sunnyside Neighborhood Energy, or SUN-NE, or Sunny, I guess. This is a project that would use renewable energy to heat as many as 500 homes in the Sunnyside neighborhood right here in southeast Portland. The idea is to create a about a 50 square block district thermal energy utility, and it would be based at the Sunnyside Environmental School. Today I have with me the two co-founders of Sunny, John Sorensen and Seth Truby, and Seth here has experience in social work, community organizing, school reform, and he also works as a professional violin maker. So Seth, I just want to say welcome.
Thanks, it's good to be here.
Great. And John Sorensen, you worked in Alaska as a cabinet maker and a remodeler with a focus on energy efficiency. And I gather you're the adventurous type. I read that in Alaska after work you used to sort of parachute into the backyard of a local pub to get a free pitcher of beer.
Yeah. usually on Saturday afternoons, the last jump.
Got it. So you're diving into neighborhood energy now, now that you're here in Portland. And I guess the first thing I want to know about your Sunny project, I mean, it sounds so good, you know, energy, renewable, heating a whole neighborhood. Is it really happening?
Well, what we know is it's already happening in other parts of the world. So our question is, why not do it here?
Why not do it here? And in terms of doing that, I mean, where are you in terms of doing it right now? What's going on with it?
Man, we have done so much work, and the community has done so much work already. We've done an enormous amount of community outreach. We've gotten support from the city. We've gotten support from community groups, from student groups to advance this project. We've had dances. We've had community energy festivals, spoken to the school district, met regularly with various community groups. All to advance this project. It's all grassroots.
So, and you expect to be having more of these events, too, which we can talk about maybe more at the end of the show.
Sure.
Right. And one thing I was talking earlier with Seth, there's no electricity with this program. It's just heat, right?
Yeah, this is a thermal energy utility. It would be structured as an unregulated thermal franchise utility, which is kind of a mouthful, but it basically means that we'd be moving hot water around the neighborhood in insulated pipes buried underground. We're not talking about moving electricity across property lines or moving gas or any other fuels. So that allows us to structure this as a community-owned utility instead of as a regulated utility.
Which makes it easier in terms of the bureaucracy and that kind of thing?
Well, yeah, it's a niche that we can operate in. We don't need any changes in the state law to create something like this. There are already existing thermal franchise utilities in the city of Portland. A good example is the brewery blocks downtown.
Uh-huh.
Whole Foods and a five-block area around there are all on a common cooling system. And so they have a franchise from the city to operate in that area. So we're using that same model, just on a larger scale and using renewable energy.
And I was sort of reading about all this, I learned that there is such a thing as district energy, which I really had no idea before, you know. And this model that you're using is based on the idea of district energy. And maybe you guys could tell us a little about what that actually is and how that works.
Sure. Well, one of the models that we've looked at to develop the Sunnyside project is to look into Scandinavian countries, for example, where they took the energy crisis of the 70s seriously. They were using a lot of fossil fuels, and they decided to change that. What they changed to was localized energy resources, a lot of thermal solar, a lot of biomass. They happen to have a lot of biomass available. What is interesting about district energy to look at these communities is they are already 100% renewably powered. and part of that uses district energy. It is much more efficient than producing heat. And heat is really important here in terms of looking at carbon neutrality and energy consumption, because 70% of all of the heat, of all of the energy used in the residential environment, commercial and residential, is in the form of heat. It's space heating, cooling, and domestic hot water production. It's not light bulbs, refrigerators, that sort of thing, computers. It's huge.
So district energy, just to go back to the first steps, district energy is a pretty old pattern of energy that goes back to the Romans. The Romans would heat water for their steam baths in a central facility and then pipe it out to multiple different baths. And so that's basically the district energy concept there. Over the years, you see large downtown areas that would often have a steam system that would take waste steam from producing electricity and pipe that around the city and use that steam to heat buildings. So New York City, for example, Manhattan, is still on a district energy steam system. And just in 2007, we heard something about the steam pipes exploding and somebody was killed. So the systems we're advocating for are a modern form of those old steam systems, and they use hot water instead of steam. So it's a lower temperature system. It's safer. It's more reliable. It's more efficient. And a really good example for that here in the States is St. Paul, Minnesota. In the early 80s, with the last oil crisis, St. Paul was one of the few places in the United States to actually invest in some infrastructure changes to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. They had an old steam system functioning downtown, and they decided to buy up that steam system to use the existing easements and to lay alongside the old failing system a new modern hot water system. So they brought that online gradually. And now St. Paul has the largest district energy system in the United States, covering about 80% of their downtown. And they've recently begun, about 8 years ago, they brought online a large biomass CHP unit, making both electricity and heat. So they're now getting a significant portion of their heat and energy in St. Paul from biomass, urban wood waste, which is a renewable resource.
Right, and it's ending up saving then in terms of resources, and it's saving people money to do this?
Yeah, so again, going back to the basic concept of district energy, you have a central plant heating water, you have a series of insulated pipes that transport that hot water through the neighborhood. And by the way, you can also do this for cooling, so you could move either hot water or cold water, depending on if you need heat or cooling. All of your end users, which can be commercial or industrial or residential customers, are hooked up to those distribution pipes. So they have an incoming hot water pipe or cold water for a cooling system, and then a return pipe that takes the water back to the system for reheating. They have equipment on site, which either radiators or air handlers, which can heat space with that hot water. You can either turn the hot water into hot air through an air handler, or if you have a radiant system, you can just use the hot water to heat your building that way. So there's different ways of using the energy at the end site. But one of the key benefits of district energy is that you get an efficiency from the centralized production of the heat. Another key benefit is that you generally have more stable prices for your energy over time.
Right. And then the third benefit, it sounds like, is that it can be renewable.
It is much easier to switch to renewable energy.
Yeah, and that's what we advocate. We're advocating community ownership, renewable energy, and relocalizing all of those energy dollars. Right now, what we do mostly in our community is we import our fuel and we export our dollars. And what we want to do is keep that money within the community.
Right, right. I want to open this up to KABU listeners if they want to call in, or if you want to call in if you're listening to this. The number here at KABU is 503-231-8187, and John and Seth here are really happy to take calls. I'm speaking with John and Seth Truby, who are the co-founders of the Sunny Project, or the Sunnyside Neighborhood Energy Project, to heat hundreds of homes in the Sunnyside neighborhood with a base thing that's happening at the Sunnyside Elementary School. And as far as this district energy is concerned, again, like another program that you guys are involved in is, it's N2E, Northwest Neighborhood Energy, which is about creating more of these district energy things all over Portland?
Well, throughout the Northwest. What we want to do is develop replicable models of this type of system. And so what we've done is we've proposed several projects, and we refer to them as small, medium, and large. But the Sunnyside project, for example, falls under a medium-sized, medium-scale project. We have a one-block project called the Salmon Street Energy Project, and then we have larger projects that we've proposed, for example, over in the northwest part of Portland, the North Pearl District. And we have a proposal over there to heat and cool the North Pearl District.
And part of it, it's probably easier to do it in a brand new new development as opposed to like Sunnyside where you have to tear up the streets and that kind of thing?
Well, I'm intrigued by that term, easier, because I'm not certain that that's really the purpose of what we're doing here.
Uh-huh.
We're not particularly interested in finding the easy solution. It seems to me as though we need a little bit of a shift about how we perceive what is easy. I'm not certain that easy translates to best. And what we do know is that existing homes are already existing.
Right.
They're not about the future.
Right. And what are we going to do about them?
Exactly. And so the Sunnyside neighborhood, take that 50 square blocks. There's approximately 30,000 square blocks in the city of Portland that already exist. Well, we have another 41 years to double that amount of property in the city of Portland. We have 30,000 square blocks of existing buildings that can be much more efficiently heated.
Right.
So that's what we're addressing.
Right. So efficiency trumps easy,
yes,
basically.
Yes.
Yeah. And the Sunnyside neighborhood itself, what made you pick that neighborhood?
Well, I love the name, first of all. if you look at the amount of energy that falls on Earth in 1 hour from the sun, that's enough energy to run every device in the world for an entire year. So think about the sun. Right in the middle of it is the Sunnyside Environmental School. It's a K-8 school. They happen to have fossil fuel oil boilers that heat the Sunnyside Environmental School. I think that's an interesting paradox.
Truly. And the old boiler's falling apart, I hear, too, right?
Right. They're gorgeous. They're gorgeous relics, but we'd like to offer an alternative to that. We think part of this project has to do with realizing what the resources are, and in part of that, it's to look at the building itself. Look at the boiler room. It is financed by all of us 12 months out of the year. But in effect, it's only used for 6 months during the heating system season. So what is that we can do with that for the other 6 months out of the year? It's not really particularly different than looking at school districts that lease out their hallway spaces to companies that site candy bar machines and pop machines.
Right.
We're not advocating sugar. We're advocating community power.
Yeah.
So it has to do with looking at that as a resource.
Hi, we have Roberta on the line. Would you like to ask your question? Roberta?
Yes, uh-huh.
Great. What would you like to know?
Well, I want to know how is this project going to be financed and what will it cost individuals to participate in it?
Well, we're in the process of getting ready to do a feasibility study for this project, and part of that study has to do with doing a technical analysis but also a financial analysis to determine the answer to your question. What we do know is the Scandinavian systems that we've looked at, and as Seth mentioned, the St. Paul system, it competes with existing utilities and it competes favorably. So we know that we can design a system that would be financially viable. The question still needs to be determined in the form of the study.
Well, when you say financially viable, if I'm living in a house in the neighborhood that's going to be this is going to be available to me, do I have to pay then to hook up, like we would have to pay to hook up to a sewer? Is it going to cost the individual homeowners or building owners a significant amount of money to participate?
We recognize that most of the people in Sunnyside and maybe the rest of Portland aren't sitting on thousands of dollars and just waiting to spend it on a new pipe coming into the house.
Exactly.
So what we'd like to do is be able to structure the project in such a way that the upfront costs are folded into the overall financed cost of the system. And this is similar to how it's done in Denmark and Sweden and other places. What's typical is when a new project is proposed in a village or a neighborhood, they will go through and offer everybody the opportunity to sign up for the new system for a fee of $100 for the first, you know, early adopters. Once the system is installed, if you're interested in hooking up to the existing, if you're interested in hooking up to the existing system, it may cost $8,000. So, and that reflects the real cost of laying the pipe and making the hookup. So there's a strong incentive to be one of the early adopters and to fold in those costs with the overall system financing. So that's how we'd like to approach that. We'd also like to access state energy loan funds so we can get low interest financing for the system in order to minimize the cost of energy to people who are on the system.
Is this kind of system eligible for rebates, energy rebates?
Oh, yes. And that's actually part of the design of the system is we typically look at all of this energy consumption individually. And what we're trying to do is shift that model into the community so that the community actually owns the system. And what happens is that shifts us out of the individual tax model into the business tax model, which I'm hoping that most listeners to KABU understand how leveraged our tax system is towards business. And what we want to do is we want to take the community and turn it, in effect, into the business tax model so that as individuals, as members of this utility, we can leverage that resource. We don't want to fight it right now. We just want to, in effect, take advantage of that resource.
So the individuals in whatever area you're working on would actually own themselves this utility.
Yes. It sounds like that's it, right? I have another call, actually, from George.
Thank you.
So thank you very much. George, would you like to ask your question?
Can you tell us whether Klamath Falls has a system like you're advocating, and this has to do with their geothermal resources? I thought that they have some kind of a system like you're talking about. I don't know who owns it. I don't even know if it exists, but maybe you do.
Yeah, they do. They have geothermal energy down there. They sit on top of a big pool of hot water, and I believe that Klamath Falls has the only geothermal-powered brewery in the nation. they make their beer from ground geothermal energy. I believe that system is owned by the city. They've gotten it's a pretty interesting project. A lot of help from Oregon Institute of Technology relative to that geothermal deposit down there. And again, that happens to be a resource that is local to Klamath Falls. We don't happen to have geothermal heat up here in Portland, but we have other resources, and that's what we're looking at. It's individual on-site renewable energy.
Just to be clear,
an example of what you're looking at, regardless of where the source is.
Yes,
that you know more about them.
Yes, and there are actually many examples around. You know, Portland State right here in town is on district energy. And the brewery blocks that we cited earlier. So district energy is actually quite common and widespread. What's innovative is focusing on renewable resources that are available locally and also trying to get into patterns of district energy that are focused on detached single-family homes. So that's something that's really innovative about our Sunnyside project is we're looking at using a residential area and putting in district energy infrastructure. So we don't see examples of that locally. We have to look to villages and towns in Sweden and Denmark and Austria. And when you look at places like this that have started implementing district energy on a neighborhood level, they really have found that it pencils out and are replicating it rapidly. For example, Austria has started building what they call mini-grids. They're thermal energy systems that usually combine solar, thermal, and biomass. They've built 300 of these systems in the last decade, and now they're exporting their knowledge, their whole industry around this to other countries.
Boy, get them to move here.
Yeah.
Another question that I had with all this is, what about the stimulus package that Obama has just passed? Is that going to be helping you guys out?
Yes, one of the parts of the stimulus package has to do with actually loan guarantees for district energy projects in the country.
Uh-huh.
And so that will alleviate a lot of burden on the part of investors.
Okay.
I'd say another link with Obama is when you listen to him talk, some of the key words that you hear him saying are energy independence, climate change, infrastructure, green jobs, et cetera, and on down the list. And when you talk about systems such as the Sunnyside system or some of the other district energy systems we're advocating for, we hit on all of those points. So it seems like this conversation is happening at the right time.
Right. Okay, Joanne, I just want to mention that I'm talking to Seth Truby and John Sorensen, who are the co-founders of the Sunnyside Neighborhood Energy District. And Joanne is on the phone. Do you have your question?
Yes, I may be too premature to ask this, but I'll go ahead and see if you can answer. Some people live in Section 8 housing through the Housing Authority or HUD. And I was just wondering, these people that own these Section 8 housing, would that be an attractive, what you're doing, would that be an attractive thing for them to become part of? Anyway, as I said, maybe you can't answer this, but I will listen.
Well, would homeowners' homes raise their value with this sort of thing, you think?
Well, we believe that would happen. What we know is that the price of fossil fuel keeps going up and up and up. It may have dips, but it keeps going up. To develop a district energy project and use relocalized resources, some of those are solar power, for example, thermal solar energy. Thermal solar energy is 4 times more efficient than making photovoltaic electricity energy. Remembering that 70% of all of the energy used in homes and businesses is heat-related,
right,
means that is a greater benefit. So to look at something like low-income housing, for example, how can we make low-income housing more affordable? Well, if you can lower the fuel cost, that will make it more affordable.
Right.
We have talked with some institutional organizations who actually get this because they are making 10- and 15-year budget projections, and they're thinking about their energy costs that far out. Most of us as homeowners are really more thinking about next year's or next month's heating bill, not so much 10 or 15 years down the road, but these institutional customers are. So if you can make a case for a steadier cost of energy over that many years, they're very interested and are right at the table to talk about it. So I think that getting some models built and operating will generate a lot of interest among owners of housing and larger projects and things like that.
Great. And so, like, if I were living in a home then with this, I could expect my heating bill to actually drop, right? Or would it at least not go up and up and up with the rise in fossil fuels?
Yeah, that's what I would agree to. I would never make the promise that your energy is going to drop.
We do look at weatherization and home energy performance efficiency as a first phase of any of our projects, small, medium, or large. We recognize fully that the best energy dollar spent is on conservation. So we're actually looking at innovative ways of folding weatherization programs into these larger projects where we're addressing both supply and demand. Weatherization programs already exist for people. I think that one of the reasons that participation rates are fairly low is that it's not really that exciting to talk about insulating your house or weather stripping. But it's pretty exciting to talk about renewable energy sources and solar thermal.
Right.
So if you can sort of sneak in the weatherization as a first phase, I think we can bring those participation rates and really button up some of these older Portland homes and make them better energy performers.
Okay, Judy, do you have a question?
Yes. Hi, this is Judy, and I actually am with a group that's working on a kind of a complementary program to what Seth and John are doing that would meet some of the questions I think that have been raised by callers about what homeowners might do in terms of not solar thermal energy, but for electricity production. There's actually legislation with the governor's climate change package that we are sponsoring a bill about that would allow homeowners to actually produce energy from solar panels on their roof, feed it into the grid, and get paid a good price for it. And these would be photovoltaic cells, not solar thermal cells. So a house could conceivably have both on its roof, as could a school or a church, so that we can become more energy efficient. And this program actually provides a financing mechanism so that people can have a way to borrow the money and get paid back, be able to pay it back, so that we can actually produce our own energy at the neighborhood level. And I don't know if Seth or John would like to comment on how the two programs might work, but I think they know a little bit about it.
Yeah, I think that, and thanks for the call. I think that these are complementary and parallel types of systems. We're addressing the thermal load of a neighborhood, and photovoltaics addresses, I think, the other
electricity,
right, which is maybe on the order of about 30% of the energy consumed. Mm-hmm. So I see them as parallel tracks. They complement one another.
Right, and it seems like your statistics again, 70,000 tons of carbon, some huge number of carbon was going to be like removed from the atmosphere if your program could get going.
Yeah, I think that's a little excessive, but we'd certainly like to get to that point.
Yeah.
What's significant is in the state of Oregon, the statistics are that about 24% of all of the energy consumed in the state is in residential applications. And about 20% is commercial. So that's 44% of all the energy consumed. And again, I have to emphasize this, 70% of that is in the form of heating. So that's the big number. It's a bigger number than all of the transportation, all of the diesel trucks on the road. This is a bigger carbon number than transportation even.
Right, and you have a solution.
Well, we're proposing it as a solution,
right,
to some of this. Yes.
Right.
The city and the state have both articulated goals in terms of reductions in carbon emissions,
mm-hmm,
and we see neighborhood energy systems focusing on thermal energy from renewable sources as one of the perhaps most effective ways of addressing that on a larger scale, where we're not doing individual projects, one house at a time or one property
right,
at a time,
right,
but really looking at
working
whole districts.
Yeah.
And leveraging the benefits of multiple parties coming together to achieve a greater result than any of us can achieve by ourselves.
Can I ask another question of Seth and John?
Oh, we're kind of running out of time, so make it
about
quick.
About energy efficiency and how that piece, there's a lot of puzzle pieces that go together here, and how they could see, because I know there are programs to do neighborhood energy efficiency projects. Do they see that they're fitting in with that whole?
Right. I think there's a lot that can be done. There's a big gap between changing your light bulbs to CFLs and changing federal legislation. We're really interested in this community neighborhood approach, mm-hmm, that we don't have to wait for federal legislation to change, mm-hmm, in order for us to do this. We don't have to wait for the city of Portland or the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon has a goal of being 25% renewably powered for electricity by the year 2025. Our research actually it was through the NICE students, and maybe we might be able to talk a little bit about them.
We're going to run out of time.
indicates that this neighborhood wants to get well past that 25% by the year 2025, so we can actually advance this in front of the state's goals.
So I just want to get to, because we just have a couple of minutes left, I want to get to events that you guys are having so that cable listeners could get involved. And there, you have a couple things coming up, which you'd just like to mention. There's a regional innovation forum on March 27th and 28th. There's a March 28th, 8 a.m. free, but you must register, free T-shirts, raffles, and the innovation forum. Then there's a change gallery on the first Thursday. I'm not really sure what these things are, but they're going to be on your website, right?
Yeah, if you check our website tomorrow.
There's about 10 of them.
If you check our website tomorrow, we'll have the listing of those events. The address is
www.n2e.org. N2E.org.
Yeah, there's just a cover page now there today, but tomorrow we'll have the events and some other information
because
on the website.
Because there's a lot of events, folks. There's about at least a half a dozen here that people could get involved. Is there any other quick things that you'd like to say for people to get involved?
Get involved. This is a community project. We would like to do this as a replicable project. It doesn't really make any sense to just do it once. If it works, we want to do it everywhere.
And you want to do it all over the city of Portland and beyond.
Exactly.
Basically. Exactly. Great.
Yeah, we're talking a lot about energy and technology, but really what this is, it's a transformation in the way a community looks at energy as a commonly held resource and not just as a commodity.
Exactly, yeah.
Our tagline is powering the community, but really it's empowering.
Empowering the community. That's great. So I want to just say that my guests today have been John Sorensen and Seth Truby. They're co-founders of the Sunnyside Neighborhood Energy Utility and also of Northwest Neighborhood Energy, N2E. And they hope to create a neighborhood utility district to heat and power hundreds of homes here in Portland with renewable energy right here in the Sunnyside neighborhood and also different district energies like this all over the city of Portland. I want to thank Paula Chernoff for doing our engineering and the callers for calling in. And Kevin McLeod is with the music. And this has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Radio. I'm Stephanie Potter, and I just want to thank both of you for showing up today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and thanks for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Local Community Radio. Coming up next, we're going to hear about a floor tile that collects the kinetic energy of those who walk on it. Todd Wilson speaks with the designer of the tile. And later, we'll hear a report on local undocumented youth and the obstacles they face. A new documentary called Papers tells their stories. Avery Welkin reports. First, a look at a new form of alternative energy generated by human foot traffic.
I am Todd Wilson, and you're listening to KBOO. Today, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Ann Redman. She is a BFA graduate from the University of Michigan School of Art and Design. She strives to combine radical concepts on energy and sustainability. She designed and engineered sidewalk tiles that produce electricity when stepped on for a project called Power Leap. Through the use of these energy-generating tiles, people are constantly involved in the very activities that create the electricity they need. Installed in public and semi-public environments, each individual will have the ability to generate electricity for their community. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
To start off, just tell us a little bit about the project.
In essence, Power Leap is a new form of alternative energy, but rather than being dependent on nature's forces, we're being dependent on something much more consistent, which is human foot traffic. And if you think about, you know, the number of days of sun we have as compared to the amount of foot traffic that passes through Penn Station every day, that foot traffic is much more consistent than how many sunny days we're going to have in a year. So we're looking towards new alternative sources of energy to generate electricity.
This kind of electricity is called piezoelectricity, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, the technology that we use in Power Leap is called piezoelectricity, and that means electricity from applied stress. So as people are walking down the sidewalk, that their energy is being transferred through this material into electrical energy. And so what we're able to do is capture kinetic energy by way of this piezoelectricity, and essentially how that material works. It's a complex ceramic that, when compressed, the electrons are forced to the surface of the material, and those can be output for electrical production.
The ceramic is the material that you actually use?
Yeah, that's correct. The ceramic compound exhibits a pretty impressive piezoelectric effect. And, you know, piezoelectricity is no new phenomena. It was discovered in the late 1800s by the Curie brothers.
Okay.
And it was originally found in materials like quartz, different salts, actually sand when you walk down the beach and you hear that squeaky noise, that's a piezoelectric effect. It's making that noise from the change of shape of the actual molecules.
Oh, wow.
Also, when you bite down on wintergreen cert, some people know this, but if you bite down on it in the dark, it makes a spark, a flash, and that's a piezoelectric effect as well.
Interesting. So this has been around for a while. What technology, or how has this technology been used in the past, or how is it being used in the present?
Yeah, in the past and kind of up until today, piezoelectricity has been used for very, very precise sensing. So it's often used in sonar, you know, underwater applications and in sensing applications. So in reverse, it can, when electricity is applied to the material, it actually deforms in shape. So sometimes that will allow for instruments to detect activity in a space. And currently, there's more investigation of using this opportunity to generate electricity through piezoelectrics.
In one of these tiles, how much energy is created?
What we're able to do is generate about 1 to 5 watts per square foot. And that's with a pretty steady foot traffic. In applications like a dance club or somewhere where people are jumping up and down in the same place and there's much more activity on that square foot, we're generating upwards of the 5 watts per square foot. In a kind of standard sidewalk application, it's closer to 1 to 2 watts per square foot.
Any idea on how much energy is used in the production of the tiles? Are any effects on the environment?
The technology itself is a pretty expensive process, and that's kind of where a lot of the research is being done today. So how can we create these materials with less energy and, you know, less time to produce the product. And essentially what takes so long is that the material has to be properly polarized so that the electrons are facing in opposite directions. Otherwise, you know, these electrons kind of go in random direction and it makes it really hard to harvest. So in that sense, there's a leap there that needs to be made to make this a truly practical technology.
Okay, and can you go into any of the details of how the ceramic is made or how you actually harness the energy from the tile?
Sure. So the ceramic is a ceramic compound, lead zirconate titrate, and that's basically compressed generally onto something like a brass shin. So the ceramic material will be a layer on the top and the bottom. And there'll be diodes on both the top and bottom also that allow us to harvest both surfaces, the electrons from both surfaces. And once that ceramic is laid on top, it goes through that polarization process where the electrons have to be properly aligned in polar opposite directions. And once that's done, it's generally coated with something like nickel electrodes to increase the conductivity of the material.
Okay. And does more pressure or weight on this tile, does it create more power? And would it be feasible or practical to do this on a large scale, like maybe putting it underneath roads or putting it in shocks in cars or anywhere where there's heavy weight that's being applied to a surface?
Yeah, absolutely. The technology, you know, is proportional to the weight, so the amount of electricity that we can get out of it is proportional to the weight that is applied or the force that is applied. So in applications like highways, we're able to harvest a bit more electricity.
Have you had any government interest or private industry interest in your project?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of interest coming from the flooring manufacturing industry. And I think there's also a lot of interest on the municipal level. So cities will get really interested and want to implement it into public utility facilities or, you know, city hall, somewhere where a lot of people travel through. And that really makes the most sense because, you know, it's most practical in a place that experiences high foot traffic. So for a city to be involved, and especially the Department of Transportation or, you know, the parties involved in the public transit of the system.
And where do you get your funding? Have you gotten any grants? Are you going to get anything from the stimulus package?
Yeah, so previously, back in 2007, I entered a competition called the Next Generation Design Competition through Metropolis Magazine. And as a result of that, Power Leap was a runner-up in this competition. And we got pretty decent press coverage, and we're also connected to Mohawk Group, which is a sister company of Mohawk Industries, a big flooring manufacturer. And they've been a pretty large sponsor for us. They sponsored one of our prototyping phases back in 2007. And since then, we've been basically privately funded. We're currently in the process of applying for some grants through the SBIR, which is actually, you know, money coming from the stimulus package.
Nice.
Solicitations were just announced recently, so we're pretty excited about getting those in and hopefully getting some funding.
Where are these prototypes that you've already come up with? Where are they installed, and what was the feedback you got from them?
Yeah, well, none of our prototypes are currently installed. We've kind of used the same format and retrofitted them multiple times. We're actually having an exhibit at a space here in Chicago tomorrow evening with the Power Leap tiles supplying the electricity. We're also doing a show in Milan, Italy, in a few weeks. And so we've basically sent our prototype around to, you know, gain feedback and exposure as well. But the way the current prototype works is basically the electricity that's generated is used to light a circuit of lights inside the tile so that when people step, they understand that they're interacting with their own energy.
And what's the approximate lifespan, would you guess, of one of these tiles? Or what would it be?
We're able to promise about a 25-year lifespan, and that's mostly dependent on the technology, as it does wear down over time. You know, these ceramic materials are brittle, and that's another element of the ongoing research, is how to, you know, preserve this material over time, preserve the integrity of the material.
Is there anybody else that's working on something similar? Are you collaborating with anybody, or do you have any future projects that might use this technology in another way?
In another way? Yeah, well, I've actually, you know, come up with plenty of concepts of how to use this, one being, you know, a workspace chair that incorporates piezoelectrics and electromagnetic induction to generate electricity from your anxiety throughout the day. There's a group that we're kind of in communications with who's applying piezoelectrics to highways and embedding piezoelectric transducers into highways to harvest that energy.
And I heard there's actually a dance floor in Europe that is using this technology.
Yeah, actually, they That's in Rotterdam. The club's called Watt. And the group Sustainable Dance Club does consulting on how to make your club more sustainable, how to save energy, how to save on your the amount of things you're wasting. And one of the products that they've developed is a dance floor that generates electricity. So they've done quite a bit of touring as well.
As far as your background, did your family encourage you to think differently or to kind of, think outside of the grid, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up outside of Ann Arbor, Michigan. My dad was one of the founding fathers of Eden Foods, which was kind of one of the very first natural food companies in this country. So we were raised on this foundation of, you know, back to the earth traditionalism, but very forward thinking at the same time. We had a solar water heater in our backyard and some solar panels that didn't really work, but we were testing them out. Passive solar house that they had built with their own two hands. And so we were living day by day as, you know, stewards to the earth and treading lightly only because it made sense to us, not because it was the right thing to do. Well, maybe it was a little bit of both, but so these kind of, you know, responsibility was definitely ingrained in me at an early age.
You're 24?
Yep, 24.
Do you think, people of your generation or young people in general, do you think it's easier for them to visualize bringing about, you know, large change?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to kind of keep at it. It seems like I've been working on PowerLate for a long time, but, you know, if you read about any inventor, any big thinker, they definitely work on projects for decades. So my advice to young big thinkers is to keep asking for what they want, keep saying what they want, keep talking about their vision, and, you know, people are going to get on the wagon and people are going to get inspired, and that's kind of how revolutions begin.
What are you planning for the future?
I think planning to, you know, first make PowerLeap a very practical product that can not only be put in the developing countries, but also, the developed economies, but as well as developing countries, and make this a practical source of energy for, you know, our electric grid, but also very remote locations.
Yeah, it seems like a technology that, you know, with India and China and all these emerging economies that are, you know, have populations far greater than ours that are on the verge of basically coming up with their own infrastructure, this would probably be a good time to get some of these things going in some of those countries, don't you think?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the concept of distributed power, which is, you know, power generated closer to the site where it's used, is much more prevalent in countries like India. And so actually the integration into systems could be potentially much more simple.
Yeah, I did an interview with the owner of a green micro gym here in Portland, and it's kind of a similar concept where they reuse a lot of the energy that's used on the exercise bikes, and he designed a treadmill that reuses energy that actually, instead of the treadmill running, you run and produce the energy just from your running on the treadmill. And so do you see anything, you know, that would be something where you could definitely kind of merge the two ideas into something where we're not just getting energy from one source, but we're using all these different sources. Is that kind of the idea that you had in mind?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, when you begin to think about generating electricity in this way, it's easy to start thinking about all the energy that's wasted, you know, throughout the entire day, and how we can not only increase efficiency, but kind of capture just the energy in a in a flag waving or the energy in a car moving across the parking lot and creating really tight loops for that, you know, cycle of consumption to production.
Yeah, it's definitely a different way of thinking. It's almost like we're recycling all the energy that we're using, so we're not wasting so much energy.
Exactly, and if, you know, if we think about physics, that's kind of, well, that is one of the fundamental laws of physics, one of Newton's laws, that energy can't be created nor destroyed. So if we can find mechanisms to efficiently harvest all of the energy, you know, present in a waving flag, then that's a much more responsible method than producing it through, you know, burning coal that's been just embodied energy for thousands of years.
And how can people find out more about your project and more about what you're doing and kind of educate themselves?
Sure, we have a great website, powerleap.net. And we hope to, well, we like to keep updated on the website as much as the current activity that we have going on. And we're currently planning some big things for the summer. So I advise people to check out the site and stay tuned.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
My name is Todd Wilson. This is KBOO Radio. And I've been speaking with Elizabeth Ann Redmond, the inventor of a sidewalk tile that produces electricity.
And finally this morning, we have a look at the lives of local undocumented youth and a new film about them. KBOO's Avery Welkins reports.
This year, over 65,000 high school graduates will not be able to go to college, get a job, or drive a car. Undocumented youth are students, workers, and active members of our communities. Yet they do not have many of the basic rights that their peers enjoy, and they have no real path to American citizenship. Papers is a locally produced documentary that tells the stories of some of these undocumented youth. I spoke with the film's executive producer, Rebecca Schein, about the inspiration behind the film project.
I started getting involved with a really incredible program in North Portland called Step Up. It's run by Open Meadow Alternative Schools. And I met some extraordinary young people. I met one young man in particular, and he was really eager to get off the streets. He was gang affected. He was, you know, moving from home to home. But he had all these incredible leadership capacities. So I helped him develop a small business. He said, well, I can't get out of gang life unless my guys come with me, because those are my people. And so he started to include his friends in doing some landscaping, in studying for driver's licenses, for getting to the dentist, a variety of things. And then they hit this wall because a number of them were undocumented. And suddenly they've done everything they can. They stayed in school. They've graduated. They've developed work skills. They've become part of the community. And it's illegal for them to be here. When they turn 18, it's illegal to work. It's illegal to go to college. It's illegal to get a driver's license. They're completely willing to follow the rules. There just aren't rules that allow them to do that. They're completely willing to do the work, to earn the rights, the privileges, you know, in American society. But there's no line. You know, people say, get in line. There's no line for these kids. There's no path for the majority of them to apply for citizenship. So they've come here as young kids. They spent their life here. They've developed, we've educated them in our schools. They've become intricate members of our communities. We don't usually know who they are because it's dangerous to share that at risk of deportation. But this is their country. This is their home. This is their community. Some of them are valedictorians. Some of them are athletes. They could be the young people that we need.
Shine's company, Graham Street Productions, is filming Papers in partnership with Film Action Oregon. Also, a group of youth called El Grupo Juvenil are involved with every step of making the movie. As they were writing thank you cards and posting donations, I spoke with Jose Manuel, Jose Luis, and Cesar about why they got involved with papers and why they care about immigrants' rights.
What do you want me to put?
So, $10? BS.
Well, the reason I'm involved in papers is because I care about human rights. I care about everybody having equal rights to pretty much do what, you know, what they want with their lives, like work or school or, you know, most on it, because it's a good opportunity to do something for this country that needs to change. What I like about it is that my friends are working here, and it's a good environment here to work with people that care about the same situation. And it's good to, I like it too, because a lot of people who write comments or write a donation or try to help, they always say good things about undocumented youth.
I'm involved in this project because I think it's a big issue that we got to do something about it. And by doing this documentary, we are doing something about it, trying to pressure the Senate to give us a reform to undocumented youth to be able to go to college at least and get a degree, or just to have a reform for immigrants that are here since they were small. What I like about this project is because I'm also here with my friends. We know each other since high school, and we learned the same thing. We have to, like, host a house party, have to go to a house party, fundraise money, do workshops in schools, and have to send emails, you know, and send letters for thanking people of donating money towards us, to our documentary that we're making. And also because I got friends and family that are undocumented, and I see how they struggle once they graduate from high school and everything, and they don't know where to go. And I just want to use my voice to help them out.
Awesome. Yeah, and like me, I'm involved because, yeah, I care about this issue, and also because I work with my friends who I've known for a while, and we're learning new skills too, and just mostly about the issue. What I take out of this from working in this documentary, I could teach it to somebody younger than me, and just so they have skills to, so people won't think like, nah, he doesn't know nothing or anything, you know. And so that's kind of part of the reason why I'm in it.
The Papers Film Project has been made possible by over 800 donations from individuals and organizations interested in listening to the hidden voices of undocumented youth. This Thursday, March 26th, from 7 to 9 p.m., the Center for Intercultural Organizing will be hosting a sneak preview of Papers to build support for this local documentary and to highlight how undocumented youth struggle in our community. For KBOO News, I'm Avery Welkin.